Authentic Tibetan Teachings and Transcripts from bodhiarchive.org.
Imagine possessing the wisdom of the entire universe. You're standing in the physical presence of the historical Buddha himself, and you're holding a magnificent jeweled parasol. But it's not a normal parasol. It's the size of a sprawling city, and you are holding it directly over his head as an offering.
Right. It's the absolute pinnacle of spiritual evolution.
Exactly. You are radiant, you're revered, saturated with insight, and yet, amidst the staggering display of devotion, someone taps you on the shoulder and asks a very simple, profoundly human question. They ask, haven't you done enough?
You know, it's a question that cuts straight to the core of how we understand spiritual effort. We operate almost exclusively within a transactional framework.
Right, the ledger.
Yes, the ledger. We go to work, we put in the hours, and we receive our compensation. We study, pass the test, get the degree. Mm. And the conceptual mind inevitably applies this exact same economic model to the realm of the spirit. Mm-hmm. We assume that if we meditate long enough or generate enough compassion, our karmic ledger will balance.
We'll have paid our dues.
Precisely. The account will be full, and we can finally rest.
The assumption is that awakening is a finish line to be crossed. But the teaching we're exploring today dismantles that assumption completely. I want to welcome you to this Dharma Dhamma teaching. Today, we are entering into a profound contemplation of a text called The Fourfold Accomplishment, a guide to the Bodhisattva Bodhi Seshu Htiva path.
It's a remarkable text.
It really is. It's a canonical Mahayana Mahayayishna Sutra Esotra, and we have it translated into modern English thanks to the 84,000 Project, which is a global initiative dedicated to translating the entirety of the Buddha's words.
And we should note the historical weight of this transmission. I mean, it cannot be overstated. We are engaging with a text preserved in the Daje Kangir, specifically in Volume 66.
Volume 66, right?
Yes. And it's a teaching that was already woven into the fabric of Tibetan spiritual life by the early 9th century. We know this because it's recorded in the ancient Dinkarma and Pangthama catalogs. For over a millennium, practitioners have rested their minds upon these specific words, you know, testing them against the reality of their own suffering.
And their own capacity for awakening. So to truly absorb the magnitude of what is being taught here, we have to first allow the setting to materialize in our minds. The text transports us to Shravasti Shra VHST, to the quiet, shaded sanctuary of the Jeta Group.
A very famous location in the Sutras Esotra.
Yes, exactly. Shakyamuni Buddha is residing there, and he's accompanied by an immense Sangha Sangaga. But the text makes it clear that this Sangha Sangha, this spiritual community, it's not merely a gathering of human monks in ochre robes.
No, it's far beyond that.
Right. The space is vibrating with the presence of advanced beings, beings who have donned what the text calls the great armor of compassion, right alongside celestial entities, gods from the form and desire realms.
It is a convergence of dimensions. You have beings who have entirely transcended human conditioning, sitting shoulder to shoulder with those who are, well, still subject to the subtle sufferings of the god realms.
And the mission of our exploration today is to systematically walk through the architecture of the path laid out before this cosmic assembly. It's a blueprint for the Bodhisattva Bodhisattva.
Which we should define briefly for the listener. A Bodhisattva Bodhisattva is a being whose defining characteristic is not merely the pursuit of personal peace.
Right. It's not just about getting out of suffering yourself.
Exactly. It's an unrelenting, fiercely held vow to secure the total liberation of every single sentient being trapped within samsara, the cycle of conditioned existence.
Which brings us back to that provocative opening image we started with. The being holding the massive 10-league-wide jeweled parasol is Manjushir Manjushri.
Ah, Manjushir Manjushri.
Yes. And in the Mahayana Mahayana tradition, Manjushri Manjushri isn't just a wise figure. He is the very embodiment, the living personification of transcendent wisdom. He's the sharpness of the sword that cuts through delusion.
He is.
And the being who taps him on the shoulder, the one who asks if he hasn't yet done enough, is a celestial god named Shuvedhadra Sribhadra.
And what makes Shuvedhadra Sribhadra question so important is his own status. The text explicitly states that he is a god from the heaven of joy who is irreversible on his path to awakening.
Irreversible, meaning he's not a beginner.
Far from it. He has reached a threshold from which he can no longer fall back into lower states of confusion. He possesses vast intelligence. So when he looked at Manjushri, Manjushri acknowledges his peerless realization and asks, have you still not had enough of making offerings to the thus gone one? It is the highest echelon of rational logic trying to comprehend the nature of an awakened mind.
He's asking for the quota. He wants to know the limits of the spiritual economy. And Manjushri reply fundamentally shatters the paradigm. He doesn't give a number. He doesn't say, almost there. He turns to the divine being and asks, let me quote this directly. Divine being, tell me, is the ocean ever satiated by all of the water that it receives?
It's such a beautiful response. Shrubhadra, tree issue as for R, must answer the only way one can. No, it is not. The ocean never overflows. It simply accepts.
Right.
And Manjusha Manjushri explains that the wisdom of Bodhisattva Sikhs is as boundless and unfathomable as that great ocean. Because the goal is infinite. The acts of devotion and offering that lead to it can never be exhausted.
It fundamentally changes the metaphor of the heart. I mean, if you view love or compassion as a resource held within a finite container, like, say, water in a pitcher, then every act of giving depletes the reserve.
You pour out the water until the pitcher is empty.
Exactly. And then you have to stop to refill it. You suffer from spiritual exhaustion. But the ocean does not operate by the physics of a pitcher. The water pouring into the ocean becomes the ocean. The capacity of a profound devotion expands in direct proportion to what it gives away.
A beautiful way to put it.
The Bodhisattva Bodhisushtava doesn't reach a point of saying, I have loved humanity enough today. The act of loving widens the perimeter of the heart.
That is the crucial shift in perspective. And Manjushri immediately clarifies that this bottomless devotion is not blind. It isn't just an unthinking, passive surrender. The insatiable nature of the offering is driven by an incredible precision of mind.
Precision is key here.
Very much so. He states that when a bodhisattva makes an offering, their mind is concentrated on four specific vast purposes. They're not merely offering a physical object. They're utilizing the object to terraform reality itself.
Let's examine the mechanics of these four purposes because they completely redefine what it means to give. The first focus Manjushri Manjushri identifies is omniscience. When the parasol is offered, or, you know, when any practitioner offers a simple bowl of water or a stick of incense, the intention is anchored in achieving the omniscient state of a Buddha.
Right. And we might ask, why omniscience? Why is that the prerequisite?
Right. Why not just focus on being kind?
Because if your vow is to save all beings, good intentions are vastly insufficient. You must possess the precise knowledge of how every individual being is conditioned. You have to see the intricate, infinitely complex web of causes and conditions, their karma that led them to this exact moment of suffering.
Without that omniscience, our attempts to help are clumsy.
We offer a thirsty person salt water because we don't understand their physiology. The offering is made to achieve the pure, unobstructed vision necessary to be truly effective.
Which leads directly into the second purpose, liberating all beings. The offering isn't dedicated to one's own peaceful retirement in nirvana near Vahana. It is entirely outward facing. The energy is directed toward dismantling the suffering of the aggressor, the insect, the loved one, and the stranger, with absolutely no distinction made between them.
And the third purpose anchors this work in time. Manjushri says the offering is focused on ensuring that the lineage of the three jewels, the Buddha, the Dharma Dharma, and the Sangha Sangha, is never broken.
It's an act of historical preservation.
Yes. The Bodhisattva recognizes that they are a link in an immense chain. They offer their devotion so that 1,000 years from now, a being who is currently trapped in a lower realm might take human birth and still find the lamp of the teachings burning in the darkness.
That's incredible. And the fourth purpose is perhaps the most expansive concept in this opening sequence. The offering is made with the focus of attaining the array of qualities of a Buddha field.
A Buddha field.
Right. And for the practitioner listening, a Buddha field is not a physical planet somewhere in outer space. It's a purified realm, a dimension of existence where the environment itself is perfectly arranged to facilitate the awakening of anyone born into it.
It's the ultimate act of environmental engineering. By making the offering, the Bodhisattva is generating the precise merit required to eventually manifest an entire universe where the soil, the light, the sound of the wind, and the nature of time itself are all perfectly conducive to liberation.
They're building a sanctuary for the cosmos.
Exactly. Hearing this, Ribhadra Sribhahastra is moved beyond measure. The rational mind surrenders to the majesty of this vision. And in his inspiration, he asks Manjushri to bestow a specific teaching. when the Manjushri had previously given to the god Brahma Shikin Brahma Shikin. He requests the discourse known as the Fourfold Accomplishment.
And Manjushu Manjushri, noting that the awakened mind never hoards wisdom, agrees.
And here we step into the architectural framework of the text itself. It's vital to recognize how this teaching is built. Manjushri Manjushri lays out 43 distinct topics. And without exception, every single topic is divided into four components.
There is a brilliant pragmatism to this structure. I mean, this text emerged from an oral tradition. For the practitioner attempting to internalize these vast philosophical landscapes, the mind requires a scaffolding. By arranging the teachings into matrices of four, the Sutra Esotra builds a memorizable palace.
A mnemonic genius.
Yes. You can mentally walk through the 43 rooms of this palace during your daily meditation, examining the four pillars that hold up each roof.
It's a technology of memory designed to sustain realization. And the very first room of this palace, the absolute bedrock upon which the entire path rests, is the generation of bodhicitta bodhicitta.
Mind of awakening.
Right. The altruistic, unshakable intention to achieve complete Buddhahood, not for oneself, but solely for the benefit of others. Manjushi Manjusoki-i defines the foundation of this mind through four primary intentions.
He states that bodhisattvas generate the intention to gather together immeasurable beings, the intention to ripen immeasurable beings, the intention to accumulate immeasurable roots of virtue, and the intention to perfectly realize the boundless Buddha qualities.
I want us to linger on that word ripen. It's a profoundly agricultural metaphor, and it tells us something essential about the nature of bodhicitta bodhicitta. We often conceptualize saving beings as a sudden dramatic rescue, plucking a drowning person from a river.
Right, like an event.
But ripening suggests a completely different relationship to time and agency. You can't force a piece of fruit to ripen by yelling at it or pulling on its stem.
No, you just ruin it.
You can only provide the sunlight, the water, and the nutrient-rich soil, and then patiently allow the fruit's own internal nature to unfold over time. The bodhisattva commits to being the sunlight and the soil for immeasurable beings across countless lifetimes.
But maintaining that environment requires an unbelievable, almost terrifying level of emotional and spiritual fortitude. And the text anticipates this. Manjushri Manjusoki-i immediately moves from the intentions to the inner architecture required to sustain them. He outlines four specific attitudes that a bodhisattva must cultivate, and he explicitly states that these attitudes must be like a rock.
Ah, the rock-like attitudes they are. Having no hostility toward those who make requests, having compassion toward those who have gone astray, not losing insight, and bringing all undertakings to completion.
I have to pause here because this metaphor demands scrutiny. If we look at common parlance, comparing a person's heart or attitude to a rock is almost universally negative.
Right, a heart of stone.
Exactly. It implies they are cold, unreachable, stubborn, or emotionally deadened. How does the Mahayana Mahayayeshna framework rescue this metaphor from implying emotional numbness?
It's a critical distinction. If the path requires infinite compassion, how can the mind be a rock? We have to look at what causes emotional exhaustion in our ordinary lives. We suffer from friction. When someone makes relentless, draining demands on our time, we feel the friction of resentment.
Yeah, we get worn down.
When someone we love deeply makes a terrible, destructive mistake, we feel the friction of judgment and despair. Our ordinary emotional capacity is porous. It absorbs the chaos of the world and begins to erode.
It's like a cliff face slowly wearing away under the pounding of the ocean.
Precisely. The rock, in this context, is not a lack of feeling. It is the presence of absolute, unshakable emotional stability. It's the end of friction.
I think of it almost like a superconductor. In normal electrical wires, as energy flows through, it encounters resistance, which generates heat, and eventually the wire degrades or burns out. That's ordinary compassion it burns out.
That's a great analogy.
But if you cool certain materials to an absolute zero state, they become superconductors. Energy passes through them perfectly, infinitely, without generating any heat or encountering any resistance. The bodhisattva's mind, cooled of ego and attachment, becomes a superconductor for compassion.
That is a remarkable way to understand it. When the text says, no hostility toward those who make requests, it means the demands of the world pass through the bodhisattva without generating the heat of resentment. When it says compassion toward those who have gone astray, it means the failures of others do not generate the resistance of judgment. The attitude is rock-like because it cannot be moved, manipulated, or destroyed by the turbulence of external conditions. It's the ultimate vulnerability protected by ultimate stability.
But an attitude alone, insulated within the mind, isn't yet the bodhisattva bodhisattva path. The internal realization must withstand the collision with the external world. How does this boundless, superconductor-like intention manifest when it encounters the reality of scarcity or material needs or complex human social dynamics?
The Sutra Esotra addresses this directly by moving from inner attitude to outer action. Manjushir Manjushetri introduces the four gifts of a bodhisattva.
And these four gifts radically recontextualize our understanding of generosity. They are the gift of the Dharma Dharma, the gift of material wealth, the gift of paper, ink, pens, and books, and finally the gift of wholeheartedly exclaiming, well done, to those who teach the Dharma Dharma.
They do recontextualize it.
When I first read this list, it tripped me up. I was looking for symmetry, and instead I found a massive juxtaposition. You have the gift of the Dharma Dharma, which represents the ultimate spiritual transmission of liberation. You have material wealth, which encompasses massive physical resources, feeding the hungry, housing the destitute. And right alongside these colossal categories of giving, you have office supplies, paper, ink, and pens.
Right.
Why drop the scale so drastically? Why elevate writing materials to the level of ultimate spiritual gifts?
Because the text is intensely practical about the mechanisms of liberation. The Dharma Dharma isn't magic. It requires a vessel. In the historical context, copying a sutra Esotra was the primary way teaching survived and proliferated.
The physical preservation?
Yes. But on a deeper level, providing paper and ink represents democratizing the tools of awakening. You are giving another being the raw materials to encounter their own mind. You aren't just feeding them for a day. You are providing the infrastructure for their intellectual and spiritual ripening. It reminds the practitioner that profound generosity doesn't require vast wealth. The simple act of providing a notebook to a student is a cosmic intervention.
And then there's the fourth gift, the gift of exclaiming, well done. Let's explore the psychology of this. We live in incredibly competitive social environments. When we see someone else succeeding, especially if they're teaching or demonstrating wisdom, the ego's immediate reflex is often subtle jealousy or comparison or the urge to find a flaw in their presentation. They did well, but...
Yes, the mind of scarcity believes that praise given to another diminishes one's own standing.
Exactly. So, to offer a pure, joyful, unreserved, well done to someone else is a profound act of self-relinquishment. In Buddhist psychology, this touches upon mudita, or sympathetic joy. It requires completely unbinding your own ego from the situation and genuinely rejoicing in the merit of another.
And the text elevates this simple verbal encouragement to a supreme gift, because overcoming the petty jealousy of the ego is fundamentally more difficult than writing a check for charity.
Much more difficult.
That relinquishment of the ego's priorities becomes the central theme of the next topic. Manjushir Manjushetri outlines the four essentials, contrasting the priorities of a realized practitioner with the anxieties of an ordinary worldly life.
Right.
The Bodhisattva views perseverance as essential rather than mere academic study. They view relinquishment as essential rather than the accumulation of possessions. They view serving the spiritual teacher as essential rather than pampering their own body. And they view the cultivation of roots of virtue as essential rather than securing a worldly livelihood.
It is a total unapologetic inversion of society's fundamental operating system. Our culture dictates a very clear script. Study aggressively to acquire credentials, accumulate possessions to ensure security, pamper the body to maintain youth and comfort, and above all, secure a lucrative livelihood to protect your status. The Sutra Esotra looks at that script and identifies it as a recipe for endless suffering in samsara samsasara.
Because those worldly priorities are inherently fragile. Possessions decay, the body ages, livelihoods are lost. The bodhisattva shifts their center of gravity to the indestructible. Perseverance in the actual experience of the teachings outweighs reading 1,000 books about them.
Right, the direct experience.
Relinquishing the grip on mind generates far more security than building a fortress of wealth. Virtue is recognized as the only true currency that crosses the threshold of death.
But Manjushir Manjushetri does not allow the listener to romanticize this inversion. He immediately introduces the friction of reality. Embracing these essentials will invite extreme difficulty. He outlines the four hardships of a bodhisattva. And these are not minor inconveniences. They are radical, ego-annihilating tests of resolve.
The first hardship is maintaining patience toward beings who are weak, ignorant, or morally compromised. The second is the intense hardship of wanting to give away all of one's possessions to the destitute, actively fighting the deep-seated biological instinct to hold something back for one's own survival.
And the third hardship is where the text pushes the conceptual mind to its absolute breaking point. Manjushri and Manju SRC states that the bodhisattva must face the hardship of not being angry at those who ask for one's head, but instead generating the thought that they are one's spiritual teacher. Let's dissect this, because a literal reading is terrifying, and a metaphorical reading demands everything of us.
Right. And the classical Jataka tells the stories of the Buddha's previous lives. There are literal accounts of him offering his body, his eyes, and his head to save others or satisfy requests. But practically, for the practitioner meditating upon this today, asking for one's head symbolizes the ultimate attack on one's identity and existence.
The head is the seat of the self. It's our face, our reputation, our intellect, our pride.
Exactly. When someone attacks your core identity, when they attempt to destroy your reputation, humiliate you, or take away everything that defines you, the instinctual evolutionary response is white-hot fury. You defend the head at all costs. The hardship isn't just suppressing the anger. It is a radical cognitive restructuring. You must look at the person trying to destroy you and genuinely, authentically view them as your supreme spiritual teacher.
Because without them, your patience is purely theoretical. If I only practice compassion when I'm surrounded by kind, agreeable people, my compassion has never actually been tested. The aggressor is the only being in the universe who can provide the necessary friction to temper the blade of my patience. They are doing me an immense spiritual favor by exposing the places where my ego still clings to self-preservation. It is a complete subversion of the victim-aggressor dynamic.
It destroys the victim narrative entirely. And this prepares the mind for the fourth hardship, which is taking birth at will due to not conceptualizing birth. A highly realized bodhisattva possesses the merit to step off the wheel of samsara. They could abide in peaceful nirvana near Vyayajna, but because of their vow, they deliberately choose to plunge back into the fire. They take rebirth in difficult, painful realms simply to be of service. They endure the hardship of existence purely out of love.
As the Sutra Esso Otra builds this towering architecture of extreme psychological demands, a very practical, almost clinical problem arises for the practitioner. If I'm trying to cultivate this level of supreme patience and relinquishment, how do I know if I am actually succeeding? The conscious mind is a master of deception. I can act humble while secretly feeding on the pride of my own humility. I can perform acts of charity while my underlying motivation is the desire for praise. How does the path diagnose the true state of the mind?
The Sutra Esso Otra offers a fascinating, deeply psychoanalytic methodology. It bypasses the curated, defensive waking mind entirely and turns to the uncurated wilderness of the subconscious. It uses the dreamscape as a spiritual diagnostic tool.
Dreams.
Yes. Manjushri Manju Essentry explains that our dreams reveal the subtle obscurations and attainments that our conscious mind refuses to acknowledge. He begins by detailing dreams that indicate the presence of dharma obscurations.
The imagery he uses is incredibly precise. He says a practitioner afflicted with dharma obscurations might dream of looking down into a dirty well or a muddy pond, but they still manage to see the moon reflected at the bottom. Or they might dream of looking up at the moon, but the sky is choked with wind, clouds, and thick smoke.
To understand the diagnosis, we must decode the symbols. In the poetry of the dharma, what does the moon represent?
The moon is almost universally the symbol for truth, for ultimate reality, or for the illuminated nature of the mind itself.
Yes. So the practitioner in this dream is seeing the moon. This is vital. It means they have encountered the teachings. They have studied the text. They intellectually grasp the concepts of emptiness and compassion. But why is it an obscuration? Because the medium through which they perceive the truth is contaminated. The water is muddy. The sky is filled with smoke.
Their perception of the truth is filtered through their own conceptual pollution.
Exactly. It is the danger of the intellectual practitioner. They know the vocabulary of awakening, but their direct experience is still mediated by a restless, agitated, or biased mind. The truth is merely a reflection on dirty water, not a direct encounter. The dream diagnoses the gap between intellectual knowing and actualized realization.
The diagnostic criteria become much darker in the next category. Dreams that indicate karma obscurations. Karma, of course, referring to the deep momentum of our past intentional actions. The dreams described here are universally terrifying. Manju Asher Shri says one might dream of falling blindly from a high cliff into a bottomless abyss, or dreaming of being hopelessly lost on a narrow, treacherous road, terrified by dizzying highs and terrifying lows.
These are nightmares of deep psychic instability. When you are falling in a dream, you have absolutely no ground beneath you and zero agency over your trajectory. This indicates that the heavy, unpurified momentum of past negative actions is still pulling the mind downward.
Right, there's no solid footing.
And the narrow, terrifying road represents the anxiety of navigating a life where you are entirely at the mercy of your conditioned reactions, rather than moving with the freedom of liberated choice. The underlying architecture of the mind is fundamentally unsafe.
And this leads into the third diagnostic category, which reveals afflictive obscurations. These dreams reflect our active, immediate destructive emotions, our anger, our greed, our primal ignorance. The imagery here shifts from instability to visceral horror, dreaming of someone convulsing in agony from a strong poison, hearing the terrifying calls of a pack of vicious predators closing in, or dreaming of one's own body and clothing covered entirely in foul, repulsive filth.
The mind is literally showing the practitioner the toxicity of their own emotional states. The poisons of the mind, the traditional three poisons of attachment, aversion, and ignorance, manifest as literal poison in the dream. The vicious predators represent the consuming nature of our desires and our hatreds. They are constantly hunting our peace of mind, stalking us in the dark.
And the filth is the feeling of being contaminated by our own unethical actions.
Exactly. The subconscious is screaming at the practitioner that deep purification is required. But the Sutra Asa Otra is not a text of despair. It provides the counterbalance. It details the dreams that arise when the purification practices begin to take effect, the dreams of profound attainment. When the mind's obscurations thin out, the dreamscape transforms into a realm of luminous clarity and deep comfort.
Manushu Manju SHRE describes the shift. You might dream of discovering a vast treasure chest overflowing with jewels, signifying the discovery of your own innate Buddha nature. You might see a pristine pool filled with blooming lotus flowers, representing purity arising from the mud of samsara. Or, profoundly, you might dream of the luminous hand of the thus gone one placed gently on the crown of your head.
The intimacy of that image, the hand on the crown of the head, it speaks to a deep subconscious realization of grace. It is the mind accepting that it's supported by the lineage, that it is not striving alone in the dark.
And this culminates in the ultimate diagnostic. Dreams that signify the practitioner is attaining the seat of awakening, standing on the very threshold of Buddhahood. Manju SHRE describes dreaming of blue roller birds or a bright golden light filling all directions. But the image that requires our deepest contemplation is this: dreaming that wherever you walk, all of the trees first reach upward and then bow down to pay homage to you.
It's an image of breathtaking poetic resonance. We have to look at the mechanics of what is happening here. When a practitioner's mind is fully purified, the artificial boundary between the internal self and the external environment begins to dissolve.
Right.
The trees bowing down signify that the natural world itself recognizes the absolute harmony of the practitioner's realization.
Their awakening isn't an isolated internal event. It's a cosmic event. The environment responds to the cessation of their internal conflict.
Precisely. And this dissolution of the boundary between internal realization and external reality provides the perfect seamless transition into the next major movement of the Sutra Asa Otra. Manjushri Manju Eshe finishes outlining the 43 topics. And the universe responds exactly as the dream foretold.
Right. Shubhadra Sribe Ishtra is so entirely overcome with joy at hearing this immense teaching that he physically scatters celestial flowers over Manjushri Manju Eshe and the Buddha.
And here the text explodes outward. It shifts from meticulous psychological instruction into the mind-shattering scale of Buddhist cosmology. Through the sheer silent power of the Buddha, a magical emanation takes place.
As Shubhadra's Sri BHHdra flowers fall through the air of the Jetta Grove, they don't hit the ground, they transform. They expand into massive, brilliant lotus flowers, each the size of a chariot wheel, floating weightlessly in the sky. And seated perfectly in the center of each of these giant lotuses is a brilliantly adorned bodhisattva.
The visual is staggering. A sky filled with luminous beings that did not exist a moment prior. Shubhadra Sribhaskara is stunned. He looks up at this impossible array and asks Manjushri Manjushri, where did these bodhisattvas come from?
And Manjushri Manjushri responds by turning the question back on him. Where did these flowers of yours come from? Shubhadra Sribhaskara admits the truth. The flowers are emanations, magical creations he projected from his own mind as an offering of devotion.
And in that admission, Manjushri Manjushri delivers what is perhaps the core philosophical teaching of the entire Mahayana tradition. He says, divine being, you should view the bodies of those bodhisattvas just as you view these flowers as emanations.
This is a direct transmission on the nature of sunyata shunyata, or emptiness. And we have to tread carefully here because emptiness is the most frequently misunderstood concept in Western encounters with Buddhist philosophy. It's constantly mistaken for nihilism, the idea that nothing exists, nothing matters, reality is a black void. How does this scene of the magical flowers correct that fatal misunderstanding?
Well, if emptiness meant nothingness, there would be no flowers, no sky, no bodhisattvas, and no teaching. Emptiness, in the Madhyamaka Madhya Amochka framework, does not deny existence. It defines how things exist. It states that all phenomena, a flower, a table, a human ego, or even a celestial bodhisattva, lack inherent, independent, permanent existence. Nothing exists totally on its own, from its own side, isolated from the rest of the universe.
Let's ground this in an analogy. Think of a melody. If I play a beautiful melody on a piano, where does the melody exist? It doesn't exist in any single note. If you isolate middle C, there is no melody there. The melody only arises in the relationship, the space, and the sequence between the notes.
Exactly.
It's entirely dependent on its parts, the instrument, the air carrying the sound, and the ear hearing it. The melody is empty of independent existence, but it is undeniably real and capable of moving you to tears.
That is the essence of pratityasamutpada, dependent origination. Because the notes are empty of a fixed, rigid identity, they have the capacity to connect, to change, to form a song. If a flower possessed a permanent, independent self, it could never grow, it could never die, it could never be offered, and it certainly could never be transformed by the Buddha's power into a lotus bearing a bodhisattva.
So emptiness is not a void.
No, it is the ultimate fluidity of reality. It's the condition that makes change, magic, and liberation possible.
So Manushu Manju Eshwari is instructing Sripadra Shri Bahadra. Do not solidify these beings in your mind. Do not relate to them as rigid, isolated entities. View them with the spacious, liberated mind that understands their dependent magical nature. And as this profound truth of sunyata shunyata is articulated and understood within the assembly, the Buddha reacts. He does something that, in sutra esotra literature, is an event of cosmic significance. He smiles.
The smile of a perfectly awakened being is never merely a social reflex or a casual expression of amusement. It is a cosmological mechanism. It indicates that an ultimate truth has been penetrated and a profound revelation is about to be deployed.
The physical description of this smile shatters the boundaries of the Jada Grove. As the Buddha smiles, the text states that light rays of blue, yellow, red, white, violet, and crystalline shoot forth from his mouth. These rays don't merely light up the surrounding trees. They pierce through the dimensions. They illuminate infinite world systems, blazing upward through the desire realms, penetrating the form realms, all the way to the highest reaches of the Brahma realms.
The scale is unimaginable.
The light outshines the sun and the moon in countless universes. And then, having touched the edge of infinity, the light rays return, circling the assembly, and dissolve perfectly into the crown of the Buddha's head.
It is the ultimate visual metaphor for the omniscience we discussed at the very beginning. The mind of the awakened one reaches out, touches and illuminates the entirety of the interdependent cosmos, and then withdraws back into its own perfectly centered, unmoving source. It is the breath of reality itself.
Witnessing this staggering display, Sripadra Shri Bahadra is moved to recite a deeply reverent poetic verse, formally requesting the Buddha to explain the meaning of the smile. He says, "Stainless, uncontaminated, and free from the three defilements, your broad face is like the full moon. Please make us understand the reason that you smile."
And the Buddha answers by revealing the true nature of the emanations. He states that the bodhisattvas seated on the lotuses filling the sky are not mere holograms. They are real practitioners. They have been gathered from actual world systems spanning the 10 directions of the universe. And the revelation that prompts the smile is this. These countless beings have all been guided and ripened by Manjushri Manju Eshwari, and every single one of them is now only one birth away from achieving complete, unsurpassed Buddhahood.
The sheer mathematical scale of this claim is what breaks the conceptual mind of the assembly. It is so vast that one of the Buddha's most senior disciples, Shariputra Sharipyutra, feels compelled to step forward and object. Now, in the Theravada Theravihta tradition, Shariputra Sharipyutra is revered as the foremost in analytical wisdom. But here, within the vast scope of the Mahayana Mahayehna cosmology, he serves a specific literary purpose. He represents the absolute limit of ordinary, rational intellect trying to grasp infinity.
Shariputra Sharipyutra cannot compute the numbers. He says to the Buddha, I possess the mental capacity to count all the stars in a 3,000-fold universe in a single second. I can calculate the cosmos, but even if I spent 100 years, I could not count the number of these bodhisattvas.
His analytical framework has collapsed.
Completely. He cannot conceive of enough physical space, enough universes, to house all of these soon-to-be Buddhas. He is trapped in the physics of a finite reality.
And the Buddha's response is uncompromising. He immediately shuts down the analytical doubt. He says, silence. Do not say that. The intellect has reached its frontier, and it must now surrender to something vaster. To help Shariputra Shariputra break through his conceptual constraints, the Buddha offers an analogy of scale. He explains that the lifespan of the Buddhas lasts for as many eons as there are grains of sand in the Ganges River. Furthermore, every single day, they deliver as many teachings as grains of sand in the Ganges, and they prophesy the awakening of as many bodhisattvas.
The Ganges sand metaphor is a foundational tool in Mahayana Mahayana literature, designed to deliberately overload and short-circuit the calculating mind. If you walk to the bank of a river and pick up a single handful of wet sand, you're holding millions of individual grains. Now imagine the entire length of the Ganges River, stretching for hundreds of miles, deep and wide. The Buddha is enforcing a paradigm shift. The universe is not a closed system with a limited capacity for enlightenment.
It's an inconceivably vast matrix.
It's an unimaginably, infinitely teeming matrix of life, and the potential for awakening is as ubiquitous as matter itself. The ordinary mind cannot measure it. It can only rest within it.
It is an entirely humbling realization. And standing in the aftermath of that realization, with his intellect humbled and his heart expanded, Shubhadra Shribhadra turns his attention back to Manjushri Manjushri. He praises Manjushri Manjushri for possessing the inconceivable capacity to guide so many infinite beings. But then, grounding us back in the dirt of the actual path, Shubhadra Shribhadra asks the most practical question of the entire text. How exactly does a bodhisattva ripen another being for awakening? What is the actual method?
Manjushri Manjushri responds by providing a meticulous list of 35 specific teachings or urgings. If the previous sections were the grand architecture, this is the daily maintenance manual. It's a masterclass in spiritual mentorship and the psychology of behavioral change. He explains that a bodhisattva does not ripen beings through magic, but through constant, targeted, compassionate friction.
Let's examine a few of these 35 methods, because they reveal the immense nuance required of a teacher. Manjushri Manjushri says a bodhisattva urges the practitioner toward timeliness, toward moderation in food and sleep, and toward the fierce protection of the Dharma Dharma. They urge them to view the cyclic existence of samsara, samsara, with appropriate fear, and to fulfill their promises without deception.
What stands out on this list is its groundedness. Before you can contemplate the infinity of the cosmos, you must moderate your sleep and keep your promises to your neighbors. The spiritual path begins with profound psychological and behavioral hygiene.
But the instruction that strikes me as the most difficult, the one that challenges our deepest human instincts regarding justice, is the urging to not discriminate among various types of beings. And Manjushri Manjushri makes this incredibly specific. He says the bodhisattva must be equally generous to those who have faulty discipline and those who observe discipline.
This point is revolutionary, and it forces us to confront the conditional nature of our own generosity. In our ordinary lives, we desperately want to reward the good practitioner, the one who is polite, who meditates daily, who keeps the precepts. We feel they have earned our time and our resources.
And conversely, we feel entirely justified in punishing, ignoring, or withholding our generosity from the bad practitioner, the one who lies, who breaks their vows, who causes disruption. We operate on a system of merit and reward.
But Manjushri says the bodhisattva must completely abandon that discriminatory logic. Why? Because the bodhisattva's compassion must function like the sun. The sun doesn't evaluate the moral purity of the objects it illuminates. It shines on a flawless diamond and a rotting pile of garbage with the exact same intensity.
The exact same intensity.
Yes. If someone has broken their discipline, they are in the grip of their afflictions, they are suffering. Therefore, they need the warmth and the generosity of the Dharma Dharma just as much, if not far more, than the perfect student. To withhold generosity because someone is failing is to abandon the core vow of the path.
It is the ultimate real-world application of the rock-like attitude we discussed earlier, remaining perfectly stable and loving in the face of another's moral failure. But the text understands human psychology perfectly. It knows that as a practitioner masters these 35 urgings, as they actually become capable of this radical, indiscriminate compassion, they enter the most dangerous phase of the path.
The most dangerous phase.
This brings us to the stark, chilling warning that serves as the climax of the teaching. Manjushri Manjushri reveals that as you approach the summit of spiritual attainment, a new, incredibly subtle, and incredibly lethal danger emerges. It is the ultimate trap of the ego. He outlines the 10 types of spiritual pride.
We usually conceptualize pride as something coarse and worldly pride in our physical appearance, our wealth, our social status, our intellect. That type of pride is obvious and relatively easy to identify. But the pride Manjushri Manjushri SHRA describes here is vastly more insidious, because the ego has co-opted the tools of liberation themselves. The ego has put on the robes of a monk.
The text lists these traps meticulously. It warns against pride in one's own pure discipline, pride in having vast learning and memorizing the texts, pride in possessing eloquence when speaking about the Dharma Dharma.
It goes deeper into the esoteric practices. It warns against pride in living ascetically in the deep forest with few belongings, pride in having achieved supernatural perceptions or deep states of meditative absorption, and ultimately pride derived from being recognized, worshipped, and praised by gods and celestial beings.
If we translate this into our modern context, it perfectly describes the phenomenon of spiritual materialism. It's the precise moment you look at someone else and a thought arises. I am superior to them because I meditate for an hour every day and they don't. Or, I am more highly evolved because I live simply, I eat a pure diet, and I don't care about designer clothes like they do.
Yes. The moment you construct an identity around your humility, your discipline, or your renunciation, you have entirely missed the point of emptiness. You've just built a shinier, more resilient, more socially acceptable ego. You have used the keys to the cage to forge stronger bars.
It's the most terrifying trap because it disguises itself as holiness. The practitioner feels righteous in their judgment of the unenlightened. But true nirvana, nirvyeshna, the absolute fruition of the path, requires the total uncompromising abandonment of pride in one's own spiritual attainments. The truly ripened bodhisattva is completely free from the arrogance of their own perfection.
They don't view themselves as a savior, looking down upon the wretched. They are entirely transparent, moving through the world without leaving a footprint of self.
It is a profound psychological mirror that Manjushri holds up at the end of this vast cosmological journey. It brings the infinite scale of the universe right back down to the quiet microscopic vigilance required in our own minds moment to moment.
It really does.
As we draw this contemplation toward its close, let's look back at the immense landscape we have just traversed together. It is a staggering progression of thought.
It's a complete map of the awakened mind.
It began with a single physical act of devotion, the 10-league parasol, and used it to reveal a boundless, insatiable intention. It grounded that vast intention in the practical fourfold architectures of our daily actions. The radical economics of the gifts, the societal inversion of the essentials, and the ego-destroying friction of the hardships.
Quite the hardships.
It provided us with the diagnostic tools to interrogate our own subconscious minds through the visceral imagery of our dreams. It then expanded our perspective outward, shattering our conceptual limits with the mathematics of infinity and the magical emanations of emptiness. And finally, having taken us to the edge of the cosmos, it brought us right back to the intimacy of our own ego, warning us against the subtle, poisonous trap of spiritual pride.
And we must recognize the final seal placed upon this text. The Buddha does not allow this exposition to remain as mere theoretical philosophy. He explicitly anchors its living power in the world. He states to the assembly that wherever this teaching is practiced, wherever it is studied and held in the mind, the Buddha himself is present. It is a living, unbroken transmission.
A profound promise.
He then formally entrusts the Sutra Esotra to three monumental figures, to Maitreya Maitreya, the Bodhisattva, destined to be the next historical Buddha, to Mahakashyapa Mahakashyapa, the great ascetic who mastered discipline, and to Ananda Ahachnanda, the attendant who perfectly retained the memory of all teachings. The Buddha officially titles this discourse the Fourfold Accomplishment, or Ripening the Bodhisattvas.
Those words, entrusted to Maitreya, Maitreya, Mahakashyapa, Mahakashyapa, and Ananda Ananda over 2 millennia ago have traveled through centuries of devoted translators, scholars, and practitioners. And now, in this moment, they have been entrusted to you. The Dharma Dharma is resting in your awareness.
As we prepare to leave this shared space of contemplation and re-enter the rushing currents of our daily lives, I invite you to return your mind to the very first metaphor that Manjushri Manjua Sheftri offered to Shuhabra Shri B. Hashtra. Reflect on the nature of the ocean. The ocean is never satiated by the water it receives. It never pushes the river away, claiming it is full. It only grows deeper, wider, and more capable of holding life.
Consider the landscape of your own life. What would it require of you to cultivate a heart so vast, so stable, that it never reaches a boundary? A heart that never says, I have loved enough today, I have forgiven enough times, I've given enough of myself. What would it actually mean when you wake up tomorrow morning to begin making your compassion truly bottomless?
Let that question resonate in the silence of your mind.
May it challenge you, may it guide your steps, and may the merit of our shared exploration here today ripen the awakening of all beings without exception. Peace be with you.
Authentic Tibetan teachings and transcripts from bodyarchive.org.